Welcome to my very first Talk the Walk podcast. Before I introduce my first guest, I thought a good place to start would be to share why I decided to delve into the podcasting world. This question takes me back to my university days. By the end of my social work degree, I still had one very big question about how we walk in solidarity with our Indigenous brothers and sisters. I mean, literally, how do we do that? When I walked out of that uni, I was committed to working with Indigenous people driven by an agenda of reconciliation. I remember feeling so inspired and passionate about living out my social work values of human rights and social justice that I upped and moved my young family from big city life to the remote north. To be honest, starting out was scary and I had no real mentors to show me the way. Like many, I was thrown in the deep end, flying out to remote communities with nothing but a listening ear to offer. For 2 years, I felt like I was in a big bucket of water with just my mouth sticking out, gasping for air, just surviving. I continually questioned, am I doing this right? Am I really making a difference? Or am I contributing to the problem? A decade later, and I can see that many of us come with good intentions, bringing all of our head, heart, and hand to this work. But how do we do it in a way that is decolonizing and authentic? What does best practice social work in Australia's Indigenous communities actually look like on the ground? While I'm not encouraging you to throw away your textbooks, there is real value in hearing stories of experience straight from the mouths of those covered in dirt, sweat, and dust. I want to bring you those stories. These are the stories that I would have loved to hear fresh out of university, and they are the stories I continue to learn from on my journey. My hope is that Talk the Walk is a valuable resource for graduating social work students preparing for their journey ahead, and a watering hole for the rest of us who are still learning every day. There will be something on here for social workers in many different contexts of Australia who come across Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander peoples in their work. Walk the Talk will also appeal to social workers internationally interested in learning more about working and walking along Australia's First Nations peoples. So, I hope you're comfortable. Grab a cup of tea and a nice sit spot, or download this episode and put it on your headphones and hit the pavement. Because it's time to talk the walk together. So here we are, our first podcast or episode of Talk the Walk in the backyard of Wisty Southers. Or more formally as Alicia Southers, but we know her as Lissy. And yeah, I've been reading up on Lissy's career, which started out as a telephone counsellor and community worker with Lifeline while she was studying at uni, the Uni of Queensland, and she finished her master's in social work in 2012. Her last placement, social work placement, was of course with Relationships Australia, where we worked together. And at that time I was Lissy's supervisor, and I pretty much headhunted her as a student from the Uni of Queensland because I pretty much wanted to find someone who could survive the NT. And she didn't disappoint. So Lissy's worked her way up from starting out as a children's counsellor in Darwin at Relationships Australia, moved into a coordination role, and now is manager of children's therapeutic services. So it was really important for me to have Lissy on this first episode because I think we pretty much had a similar journey. We both studied at the same uni. We probably both graduated feeling a little out of our depth when we decided to go into this field of work. And we landed in the NT pretty much to try and learn on the go and make use of whatever resources we could find around us. And I think Lissy will have lots to share with us, particularly for new grads that are feeling a little bit wobbly like we were when we first started out. And I'm hoping she'll have some encouraging words for us so that those new grads out there might know it's a leap worth taking. So, Lissy, thank you for joining me today on this beautiful dry season afternoon.
You're welcome.
I was just reflecting this morning on a blog that you wrote for my website a few years ago, where I was reflecting on culturally fit social workers. And I will put a note on the show notes, or a post on the show notes, for anyone who wants to go back and read that later on. But it seems like a lot has changed, even in that short period of time when you wrote that reflection. And I know we've talked before, it's quite common for social workers arriving in the Northern Territory to be kind of thrown in the deep end immediately and often get promoted quite quickly up through the ranks. Can you relate to this at all?
I guess, a short answer is yes. You know, maybe from the outsider's opinion, it would be within a 6-year period from being freshly graduated to now. I've moved from, a practitioner into coordination and now into management under 6 years of experience. So some might say that's quite, it's quite quick.
So why do you reckon that is? Why do, social workers arriving in the NT, some of them quite fresh, why do you think they move so quickly up through the organisation?
Not to discount the skill that the worker has by any means. So people who come up here fresh, you're obviously looking for a challenge because Darwin's known to be a very transient population. So majority of us aren't actually from here. So our support base, our family base is elsewhere. So for that alone adds that challenge. We live in the territory with probably the largest population of Aboriginal people. So that culture and that presence of that culture is really sort of, you experience it every day. And that's not just when you visit communities, that's in the urban setting of Darwin City or Palmerston City. So that in itself, and I guess also the under-resourcing that occurs, and that's not to say it doesn't happen in other states, but the remoteness of the work also presents the lack of resource challenge. So you do have to sort of be adaptable, I felt, to come up here. It was a huge, huge learning curve, and it is a shock to your system when you first arrive. Anyway, that's been my experience as a student. Because I wanted to come up here, you're sort of half prepared, but there's an aspect of Northern Territory and social work and remote work that you can't be prepared for, and it's on the job learning, by experience. And that's something really rare. I mean, you do that in every job that's new to you, but culturally and the specific type of skills required in remote work, it's something different. It's not something you can completely describe. It's something that you have to invite people, encourage people to give a go for themselves. And I'd really invite people to seriously think about remote work and not just Aboriginal culture, but called as well, like working within different cultures.
For those listeners who don't know much about your background, could you give us a bit of a history, how you arrived at working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? What was the journey there? Where did it start?
Yeah, that's actually interesting because I was sort of pre-reading some of the, some of the ideas or questions we might have been discussing. And this one was sort of like I really had to think about it because I'm from Ipswich, Queensland. And I guess, Aboriginal people identify as Aboriginal in my town, but it's a different experience of that identity and culture in Ipswich than it is here. And it was actually through uni that I took my human service degree. The lady, my lecturer's name, I think, was Diane, and it was just a Aboriginal history and cultural course. And, the first couple of weeks was all about our history, like Australian history, but not necessarily the colonisation. It wasn't the European version. It was actually our Aboriginal people's history. So some might say the proper, correct Australian past. And I think what I just remember it blew my mind that this was the first time I was hearing about the real oppression and I guess the real dark secret side that you don't learn in primary school or even in high school. You're almost fed like a, and this is just my take on it, a fairy tale version of what happened. And I just remember, yeah, feeling disappointed that this isn't actually taught. And I don't identify as Aboriginal myself. I know that my history lies within the European bloodline. But I just really connected on that understanding of that level of oppression. And being in that area of study anyway, I think it sort of really perked my interest. It was something I didn't realise I had an interest in.
Yeah, I can really relate to that too, having gone through primary school and high school without any knowledge at all and even not knowing culturally your own backyard growing up, what history there was. Can you think of a time when perhaps early in your life, maybe going back to your childhood, I'm not sure how far back you would go, but has there been some kind of influence from childhood that has kind of taken you on this path of working in this area?
So growing up, my mum used to joke that I'd probably be a lawyer. It could be the older sibling in me where I always wanted to be right, or things always had to be fair or just. So I don't know, this whole value or concept of things being just or fair has always sort of been within me. Obviously things grow in time and you sort of learn that life isn't fair, but that social justice value has always stuck within me. But it wasn't necessarily early childhood that sort of cemented my fate. It was sort of young adult, and I was studying human services at the time, but I did find out through my studies that a friend of mine had committed suicide at 21.
Mm.
It's just one of those reality checks that you're immortal. You're not immortal, sorry, and I wanted to be able to help people. It just sort of reaffirmed that, I wanted to support not just people going through that particular circumstance, but I was in the right field because I have this empathy for others and want to support those that might just need that extra.
So these values of justice and fairness were ones that you really connected with at that point in time. How do you think that's fed into coming to the Northern Territory and working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? How do those values play out in your work?
I guess the obvious connection is that, you know, given the history, and it's also the recent history in the Northern Territory with the intervention, the injustices that have occurred. I don't identify as Aboriginal, and some Aboriginal people might have a different view of that, but it made me reflect that we've got a long way to go. It's taught me to be more mindful up here as well in my practice. So even though I might be driven by social justice, I've got to remain accountable and acknowledge that other people have that separate opinion too. So in order to follow that sort of, value, you've got to respect the fact that others see different and acknowledge those differences. And maybe we'd be in a different place if that had occurred with our Aboriginal people as well.
You spoke about the NT intervention. I kind of got the feeling that that was a bit of a challenge for your values, particularly around social justice and fairness. Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could speak about, in practical ways, what has that played out in your work, that challenge around the NT intervention and not everyone supporting it?
It really drove home this term that I've heard once or twice, but it doesn't speak up a lot, but white privilege and how much of it I have and how it's almost a dirty word for some people, which I'll never understand exactly why, but it did drive that home a little.
So what do you mean by white privilege?
Just from being the colour I am allows me to hold a certain status just for being, just existing, really, essentially, is how I see that privilege. And if you want to separate that again, I also come from a privileged background in the sense of family and education. So even that of myself gives me a status compared to others. Yeah.
So the way you see white privilege and your awareness of that, how do you see that playing out in your work in order to overcome some of the challenges, I guess?
Like with any sort of difficult problem you might come up, it's important to acknowledge certain things. So for me, it's important when working across culture that I acknowledge that I come from a different one. So I'm obviously not Aboriginal person. I don't pretend to know, you know, all Aboriginal values and law. I try hard to not make assumptions. And if I do, I would openly have hopefully invite others to make that aware, which I, you know, as a student, these are things you have to sort of work out for yourself, and you have to work it out pretty quickly, to be honest. Like on the Tiwi Islands when I started my student placement, these were the sort of things that you have to, I probably couldn't have named it as privilege right then and there. It's only after years of working and that I sort of can comfortably name it now. But you have to learn very quickly when you're in a, when you're probably one of the only white people you could count on one hand, and the rest are your, you know, are the Aboriginal people. It's something you have to acknowledge pretty quickly.
So can you give some examples of, like, when you were working on the Tiwi Islands, how that played out?
When it comes to, yeah, when I was a student and realising how this white privileged narrative sort of played out in that placement, was you sort of go over with this naivety, like you're not worried, and in a way you're not scared. I don't know, you just feel like you're not going to be harassed necessarily. Whereas I imagine it'd be a very different experience for an Aboriginal person who maybe was flying to an all-white city, or, you know, coming to a meeting with all-white people. They would probably carry some anxiety with that, possibly. But I don't know, you just have this security about you, a security blanket, so to speak. I mean, the Tiwi people are beautiful people. The first thing I noticed was how white I was, obviously, when I first rocked up. But then after a while, I realised, you know, this is that white person, the way they think. It's reason people are paying attention to you isn't because you're white. It's you're a new person on the community. But naturally, you think it's all about you sometimes. you make all these assumptions, I guess, is probably how that plays out the most, is instead of sort of sitting down and approaching and talking to the members of communities, you sort of assume certain things about how they see you or think or feel, and that won't necessarily be the case.
So it's almost like you're referring to some communication challenges there too.
Yeah,
would that be one of the trickiest things about working out in remote communities? The ways of communicating, yeah. and how easily communication can be lost or misinterpreted. Mm.
I think the beautiful thing about it, though, is that there's definitely miscommunication. But it's, once again, it's that there's no wrong or right way. It's finding how you can meet or understand one another. And so, you know, I can't speak for all the different language in Aboriginal culture, and this is just from my experience of trying to, you know, talk with the Tiwi women. You know, it's not just a verbally different language, but it's also, because they speak English too, there's also the body language and the tone and even how context, how things are phrased. So once again, sometimes it took me a while for me was maybe white person will ask a question, whereas maybe one of the old ladies would be like, get me a cup of tea, and I could take that as a demand. However, you know, through their communication, that's actually a question.
It's almost an invitation.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's an invitation. It's not, yeah, it's not a demand. But, you know, for a white person, there isn't any question. There wasn't, you know, please and thank you isn't necessarily part of the cultural language. Whereas, and that's where this white privilege and having to understand that comes into it, is just because I use please and thank you, it shouldn't be assumed it's part of someone else's way of engaging, practicing, communicating. And especially when you're on their country. And they're all hard lessons to learn because, yeah, the old ladies aren't scared to tell you.
So can you talk about some of the skills, the knowledge, your abilities that you've developed that you didn't have before doing this kind of work? What has really become a strength for you now, going through the hard way to learn, really, diving in the deep end and going out to a community you don't know? Yeah, what do you think is some of the real skills and knowledge that you've developed now that's helped you in your work?
Yeah, so I think one of the important ones is communication and ways you can communicate. Patience is another huge, you know, in order for you to be effective, you've sort of got to keep yourself balanced. You don't want to sit within an overreactive space, an assuming space, and things take time. It's like learning. It's like learning, and it is a new skill. Essentially, remote work is its own set of skills. So patience and communication, they're the biggest ones. You've got to be open and transparent, I find, as well. I think that really helps build a relationship, if not a little quicker.
And building a relationship is so important.
Oh, that comes first. That comes first. That should have been at the top, yes.
So what are the ways of building a relationship that you found really helped?
Time. And I think, as I said, once again, you've got to acknowledge who you are. I find sitting back, waiting, observing, taking cues from those members within the community, not just barging in there. I'm here, you know, I'm the new worker on the island. I'm here to do this, and expect people to be falling over you, grateful that you're here to help the community. It does the opposite, actually. It slows your process down. And in no means are you acknowledging who you are and as I said, that status that you bring with yourself. But if you're entering in that very soft entry of, you know, yeah, I'm here, but this is new for me, and you have been living this way for a certain, you know, for a long time, and I want to understand. So that's sort of what you're trying to get that message across, I guess, when you enter that new culture. That's been my experience anyway, as I can't speak for everyone.
And that's not something that comes easily to a lot of people, is it?
No.
Taking time, sitting back, being prepared to listen.
And I think some of that comes from pressure. People have this, you know, the pressure to get outcomes and stuff from their work. So it's good if you've got an organisation that's supportive and understands cross-culture and, like, cultural practice and competency, because it takes time. That's the reality of things. And we haven't even began to talk about, or we probably won't even touch on, though, like, actually running programs remotely. So just the startup itself, just to even walk in and introduce yourself, 6 months even, you can still not be seen as contributing member yet to the community. Because there is a history of us, you know, white people coming in and out as we please. So for social and community workers, it's important that we don't become that narrative either.
So this idea of just really taking your time to get to know a community out of respect, mutual respect, to develop a relationship of trust, can you speak of the values that underpin that kind of thinking? Because that's, yeah, like I said before, it's not something easily learnt.
I think I can thank my family for that. I've been lucky enough to have a pretty strong family unit growing up, and, you know, we all respect each other, and it's known that we're loved and we matter to our unit, our family unit. So I guess with that comes those learnings of loyalty and that we trust and love one another.
And family is such a huge thing in Aboriginal communities too, isn't it?
Exactly.
care that's and exactly love for right. an and extended
that,
family.
You know, that might be one of those connections that helps me understand that you have to work at things. But I can understand, you know, having such strong bonds to my family, how, yeah, I can only sort of touch the top of the iceberg, though, on what family means for Aboriginal people.
And so was there any particular person in your family influenced the development of this value around family and how important that is and loyalty to family?
Mum and Dad, but I must, like, my father's family are very, they sort of reflected what my immediate family are as well. Very, very supportive of everyone, my aunties and uncles, supportive of all their nieces and nephews, you know, would come and support you at sports or birthdays, and we'd have a lot of weekends together. I really understand that. I've watched aunties drop everything to come and help mum or help myself, and mum do the same for them. I get that loyal, yeah, that understanding of family member needs you, you help them. And why would that be questioned, sort of thing, naturally. I think growing up, that was, yeah.
You spoke early on in our conversation about other ethics or values that are important to you, being justice and fairness. Can you think of any particular people that might have instilled those kind of values in you, or any particular events that happened in your life that contributed to the development of these values?
I mean, I played a lot of sport, so I guess team sport.
Mm-hmm.
The game itself, you want it to be pretty fair in regards to umpiring and all that. I also sort of did a bit of debating. I feel like it was just part of me almost when I think about it.
Was it a coach in the team sport that you played?
Well, funnily enough, my auntie coached me, and she coached me up through from when I was a kid to up through rep till I was about 17, and then I stopped.
So if your auntie was here now with us listening to this conversation, what story would she tell me about the way that you developed this justice and fairness in your life and how it's influencing your work now?
Good question. Probably the same as my mum, that, you know, and I was also the eldest cousin, so it was me for a very long time with just my parents and my grandparents and everyone doting over me, and then gradually the others joined. So I had to share attention. I don't know if it's an older, like if other people who are older siblings experience it, but you want people to be treated the way you were treated. And if it's different, you start to ask questions. So I'm the oldest of four, so I've had a bit of practice with that. And then on the cousins' side of things, there's 20 of us. And I guess because you're the eldest, you kind of almost felt like the gatekeeper of them slowly, because there was more of you. You would sort of want to take charge and make sure everyone was playing fairly. And if they weren't, it'd be why? And you'd get upset or you'd run and tell mum. So I don't know, Kate, you know, my auntie might reflect on that.
There's an element of equality I hear in that story.
Yeah. Even my opinion of that's changed being up here though.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak about that?
Yeah. So, and I guess it molds into the social, but there's this drawing, and it goes around Facebook a fair bit, but of what equality looks like. And it's got people on different heightened boxes, but they're all level at the top, if that makes sense. And I couldn't paint it a different way, to be honest, like in a visual aspect. You know, you want everyone in the same place at the end of the day. And that's it. That's when privilege starts to join into that conversation, because I was able to get to a certain level, which I'd maybe want someone else who didn't start with my status to be at. And it might require them to get, for example, free education. Mm. Whereas I could afford education.
Mm.
It's not necessarily their fault that they can't afford education, but they still should have that opportunity to reach the level I'm at.
Mm. So that Facebook picture you were talking about is two children standing on boxes that are on different levels, but they're actually at the same height.
Correct,
Looking over the fence. One person has a higher box because they actually need a little bit of extra.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
While the rest of us might be able to stand on the lower box.
Whereas I think a lot of people, instead of focusing on the fact that people are now on a level playing ground and we're much stronger as a unit, like together, people are so focused on the heights of those boxes that everyone else gets.
Yes.
And I've, you know, that came really apparent to me coming up here and working in the NT and then occasionally having conversations with people here as well, but and then going back into state and hearing weird questions that I just, yeah, I'm just like, where does that even come from? Why did you ask me that?
One of the things that came to my mind is a bit of a myth that, you know, a whole lot of money is thrown at Aboriginal issues and they get so much. They get free housing. They get
Yeah, there's some of the weird things that people ask me. Yeah, so I have to also remain a professional face response when that happens too. So, and that's just a lack of knowledge, I guess, or I don't want to call it ignorance. And some of it might be fear and that anxiety of knowing. Because as I said, I think for some people, white like that word privilege is a dirty word. People don't want to admit they have it or it exists for some reason. You'd much rather it be attached to your status than sort of not. It's not to persecute. It's to just, it helps you gain understanding, if anything.
We could talk all day on white privilege. That's probably another whole conversation another time, and I reckon we could do it.
I know, but I'm so sure there are people way more qualified than me with a lot more experience that could really speak to that.
Well, I think how many years out of university? Five, six?
Six. Yeah.
To have that level of insight and awareness, sometimes it takes people 20, 30 years to get to that point. The environment we're in, we're thrown in to, yeah, like you say, communities where you're the only white person and it's in your face. So you have to do some hard learning quite quickly.
Yep.
So what can you tell me what you think sets social work in Indigenous communities apart from social work in other contexts? What is it that you think or do differently than you would if you were on the East Coast?
I think you have this, I don't want to call it fear, but you've got this remoteness. So there is this big sense of autonomy that you have to work with. You've got to really use initiative. You've got to be really resourceful. You've got to have, you've got to learn your values and who you are quite quickly and trust that you know them and you trust that you're making those decisions based around your values and those core ethics because of that autonomy, because you don't necessarily have that backup support straight away. It's okay to not be, I guess, as a student, you're always doubtful of your abilities, you know, because you're not necessarily able to name what you're doing, but you are doing it. And it takes, that's why you have supervisors, that's why you have supervision, to help name those processes and the way you're thinking, to sort of, you know, name that doubt that you're feeling something else and build your confidence that way. It's just, as I said, sometimes really hard to describe remote, like Aboriginal, cross-cultural, any, like remote cross-cultural work. It's half of it I've just named, but half of it is just being here and experiencing it for yourself. It's a sink or swim situation often for people that come, not just new students, but practitioners who have decided that they want to come up from the East Coast up. You just get thrown into it. Hopefully your employer has some cultural training as part of your orientation, but in saying that, you've got to take responsibility and read and do some learning on the side yourself too. But yeah, I would have said your core ethics, they're important. You must have them up here because of the autonomy, the lack of resources.
And you touched on before how important supervision is, but often when you're in a remote community, getting access to that can be a challenge, and even accessing training opportunities are more challenging.
And that's where that resourcefulness comes into it, where I've heard that the workers within the community will then create their own network. So they'll almost create their own little supervision network with one another as to how they get around all the other things like basic practices of confidentiality and all that. Well, that's, you know, to be developed. But this is what I'm talking about when it comes to being resourceful. And if you want to keep doing that job, you are going to have to find those outlets. That supervision, your self-care. I'm sure remote workers often have to use telephone counselling to access support. I mean, but even phone lines and internet can cut out, like it's its own world up here.
And when you said resourcefulness, the other thing that come to mind is really your own inner resources, not just what's external to you and people around you. Can you speak to some of the inner resources you've developed over the years?
I've learnt not to panic, and that I can swim and I don't necessarily sink. I mean, I know I'll probably splash around and at times look like I'm drowning, but I'll find my footing. So I think it's that inner faith in yourself, and that does, it just comes from exposure. I can't offer any sort of secret advice as to such, except maybe have faith in your abilities. And I guess as a student, if you're up here on placement, say you weren't happy with the supervising support, you could look at other options, because that is so important as well, that you have a supervisor who understands why you're here, which is to learn. But you're still learning very quickly, even as a student up here. Because once again, once you're a professional, you're autonomous, trying to, find those resources so that you can even have a student sometimes. Sometimes you want a student, but you can't even have a student.
That sounds like another story there.
Yeah.
I'm interested in this inner faith that you talk about and the ability to sink and not swim. Is that something that has been useful in other parts of your life?
I guess just on the moving up here. But I think what helped me was I went overseas to do a camp. And I did that on my own at 19, and I'm a different person to when I was 19, at 19. Mm. But I remember feeling those same emotions coming up here. But I think I was a little bit more stressed because it was for my education and there was a real result coming from being up here. But what kept me calm, again, was that I've done this before.
Mm.
So what's to say I can't do this again?
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, there were moments and tears, as you would know. And once again, that's just that, you know, when two cultures collide, there's a lot of learning. And
I think you should tell a funny story.
Yes.
I think it would be good
right
now to tell a funny story.
Yes. So we were doing bush camps, so they went for about 3 or 4 days. And so Lucy and I were sort of facilitating. I was helping Lucy facilitate her camp. Anyway, we were running groups and I only brought one pair of shoes. Yes, I know. So I put my thongs behind me to run the group. Anyway, the group finishes and my thongs are nowhere to be seen. You know, I was fighting like these emotions, which was, I was angry. But at the same time, I wasn't, because I was sort of understanding, because I had this knowledge sitting with me that we perceive possessions so differently from my experience. So other people might see it differently, that, you know, Aboriginal culture, it's very sharing, you know, what's yours is mine and mine is yours. And to be fair, we were sharing food, we were sharing stories, you know, meals together, camping, hunting, everything was together. So why shouldn't my thongs be something else that was shared together?
And basically you never saw them again.
No, I never saw them again. Lucy sacrificed her shoes, so I wouldn't be barefoot on my way home.
Oh, it was a very funny
but
thing looking back on,
yeah,
wasn't it?
At I can laugh. I can laugh now. For you were like a hostage negotiator with my mind, helping me quickly process, because there's really, you know, we're there for the family, so it's not really a time to make it about yourself, especially over something as simple as shoes, which I've sort of tried to actually embrace that part around possession. I mean, I still like nice things, but I've noticed that I've slightly shifted in that things are just things, they're possessions. You can get another one. You know, it might not be as pricey or nice as you want, but you'll be resourceful and find something you need. So it's definitely something that's sort of rubbed off on me slightly.
Isn't that funny?
And that's not to say that, you know, Aboriginal people don't love nice things either. Of course we all do, but there's just this different emphasis on what things mean.
It also brings to mind that a sense of humour is also very important in the work, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. You can't take yourself too seriously. And that's also like a care factor, a self-care factor for me anyway. You have to quickly find coping strategies, and laughing worked for me. Definitely worked for me, because your options were laugh or cry, and sometimes crying isn't quite as effective depending where you are. So it's better to just laugh.
I realise that our time is coming to a close very soon, but I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the future, or what you might be working on right now, or what the future holds for you.
So currently overseeing Darwin and remote top-end programs at RA, but Alice Springs also have amazing children's programs running.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're hoping to do is work together to streamline the way that we provide our interventions to children and their families within our organizational framework.
So we're taking some learnings from Alice Springs, because it's a different context down there too,
isn't it? It's completely, and like not one shoe will fit all, of course. It's more of that, that framework of practice and some of the processes within that. But that is, to acknowledge that, as I said, different, even with Aboriginal people themselves, each tribe, each mob have different practices. And
so it's about finding something that is general enough to work in both areas, Darwin and Alice Springs.
Yeah.
So just summing up, a last piece of advice for anyone out there who might be thinking about doing social work in Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander communities, what might be some final words for those folks?
Just do it. Don't second guess it. I'm not one to sugarcoat things. It's pretty intimidating. It's hard. At times you learn a lot about yourself. You're faced with some really ugly truths sometimes. You grow up so quick. I honestly, it's my opinion that students should have to do some sort of remote work or like cross-cultural work as one of their pracs. But honestly, even though I hope I didn't paint a horror, like, it's one of the best experiences you can do. I've absolutely just loved every moment of it. There have been tears. I've felt furious. I've felt confused. I've been absolutely upset. I've been down. I've had every emotion in that rainbow. And would I, if I could go back, I'd do it all over again. Every single moment of it, I would happily do again.
Mm. So why do you think it's really important that all social workers have a practical experience in the bush or in remote areas? Why is that so important to you?
It's about that, the learnings you get from a remote experience. It just unlocks this part of you that you weren't sure you had. And I don't know if it would have ever got unlocked if I'd stayed on the East Coast and done a position in the city. I honestly believe that I would be a different practitioner / person if I'd stayed and not come up here. So, and that's like, I'd put my hand on a Bible and swear that would be the honest truth. But I'd just encourage students to, even if it sounds scary, just trust in your supervisors, trust in the organization that's accepting you as well. Take that leap of faith and go for it. I didn't regret a minute of it, so
just do it.
Might not be able to say that with Nike, but yeah, just do it. Give it a go.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Lissy, this afternoon talking with you on Talk the Walk. And I wish you all the very best for the future, whatever that holds.
Thank you.
You've got some pearls of wisdom for everyone, whether you're new to the practice of social work in Indigenous communities or if you've been around for a long time. I'm sure you'll have some insights from this afternoon to take into the future. And one more question.
Oh, yeah?
How can people connect with you, either online or in person, if they want to, maybe you've said something that's really sparked their interest, or if they want to follow up with you with a question, how might they get in touch with you?
So I do have a LinkedIn account. I think it's under Liz Southers.
I think that's probably a good idea. LinkedIn account, yeah. Your email address is there. People can connect with you.
Oh, good. My email address is there. Excellent. Yeah. Okay, that's great. You can hit me up on that.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities. You'll find all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. So if you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.